Welcome to Washington Today for Monday, August 22nd, 2022. I'm Gary Sterikoff. Thanks a lot for listening today. Here are some of your headlines. Dr. Anthony Fauci, who played a critical role in steering the country through the AIDS and COVID-19 pandemics, announced today he is stepping down from his job at the end of the year. Dr. Fauci has been director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases since 1984. He is also chief medical advisor to President Biden. We'll hear more from Dr. Fauci, the president, and the top Republican on the House Oversight Committee coming up. The federal judge who signed the warrant to search former President Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate is hinting that we may not get to see the affidavit that was used to justify that search. Federal Magistrate Judge Bruce Reinhart said in a written order earlier today that he asked the Justice Department to provide proposed redactions to see whether there was anything he could release publicly or whether the proposed redactions could render the document meaningless. The judge said he would not make a decision about unsealing the document until he reviewed the government's proposed redactions pending potential appeals. That could mean the affidavit may not be public for some time, if ever. Tomorrow is primary day in New York and Florida. In Florida, Democrats will be choosing their nominee in the governor's race between former Governor Charlie Crist and State Agricultural Commissioner Nikki Fried. The winner will run against incumbent Republican Governor Ron DeSantis. Democrats are also choosing their Senate nominee to run against incumbent Republican Marco Rubio. Current Representative Val Demings has a big lead in that race. And in New York, a complicated and drawn-out redistricting process has made some House Democratic incumbents vulnerable. Longtime Representatives Carolyn Maloney and Jerry Nadler will square off against each other in the 12th District. And Representative Sean Patrick Maloney is facing a progressive challenger, State Senator Alessandra Biaggi, in the 17th District. And that district had been represented by Democrat Mondaire Jones, but he is now running in the new 10th District, where he faces a tough race against a large field that includes Dan Goldman, who was one of the House lawyers in Donald Trump's first impeachment hearing. Also in Oklahoma, they're holding its Republican primary runoff election tomorrow. That's between Representative Mark Wayne Mullen and former State House Speaker T.W. Shannon. The winner will be a heavy favorite to fill the seat left by retiring Senator Jim Inhofe. We begin here in Washington, where the man who played a critical role in steering the country through the AIDS and COVID-19 pandemics announced he is stepping down from the job at the end of the year. Dr. Anthony Fauci has led the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases for 38 years. He is also President Biden's chief medical officer. And in a statement, Dr. Fauci said, quote, "While I am moving on from my current positions, I am not retiring. After more than 50 years of government service, I plan to pursue the next phase of my career while I still have so much energy and passion for my field." In a statement, President Biden praised Dr. Fauci as a dedicated public servant, saying, quote, "Because of Dr. Fauci's many contributions to public health, lives here in the United States and around the world have been saved. As he leaves his position in the U.S. government, I know the American people will, and the entire world, will continue to benefit from Dr. Fauci's expertise in whatever he does next." And congressional Republicans are also weighing in. House Oversight Ranking Member James Comer of Kentucky said in a statement, quote, "Retirement can't shield Dr. Fauci from congressional oversight. The American people deserve transparency and accountability about how government officials used their taxpayer dollars, and Oversight Committee Republicans will deliver." Russian authorities have blamed Ukraine for organizing the killing of Daria Dugina over the weekend. She's the daughter of a prominent supporter of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Ukrainian officials have denied anything to do with the car bombing that happened on Saturday that killed the 29-year-old on a highway in an affluent district outside of Moscow. Russia's domestic intelligence agency issued a statement on Monday saying that the attack was prepared and committed by the Ukrainian intelligence agencies. That claim could not be independently verified. Wednesday marks the six-month anniversary of Russia's invasion. It's also Independence Day in Ukraine. And here's State Department spokesman Ned Price talking about it at today's briefing.
All questions on Russia-Ukraine, but first thing first. This week, Ukraine celebrates its Independence Day. President Zelensky warned that there will be a particularly nasty Russian attack ahead of the holiday. I just wonder how much, based on your assessment, your intelligence information, how much you can back that assessment, and if so, what kind of reaction will that invite from the U.S.?
I don't have any intelligence, you won't be surprised, to share from the podium, but what I can tell you, Alex, is that we are going to mark together with our Ukrainian partners Ukrainian Independence Day on Wednesday. Not only will this be Ukrainian Independence Day, what should be a time for joy and celebration on the part of Ukrainians in Ukraine, but also around the world. But of course, it's taking place in the context of what has been Moscow's brutal aggression. And Wednesday, probably coincidentally, will also mark 6 months of this brutal aggression. There is no question in our minds that Russia will continue its brutal assaults on the Ukrainian state, on the Ukrainian people, on Ukraine's independence, its democracy, its territorial integrity as well. There's also no question that we will continue to stand with our Ukrainian partners. You saw on Friday, we announced an additional presidential drawdown, our 19th presidential drawdown, $800 million. Dollars in that drawdown alone. That brought our total of security assistance to Ukraine to about $10 billion since the start of the invasion, more since the start of this administration, and we'll continue to do more, as will our partners around the world.
Also at today's briefing, the topic of a blanket ban on visas to Russians. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky had first urged the visa ban in an interview earlier this month with The Washington Post, saying Russians should, quote, live in their own world until they change their philosophy. Here's more from Ned Price.
The State Department also was quoted today as saying that it does not support a blanket visa ban against Russian citizens. It's important to draw a line between the actions of the Russian government and the people of Russia. I'm quoting the official was quoted on the media. You said from the get-go that it depends on Russian people to stand up against the regime, you know, to address its behavior. I'm just wondering, how do you expect them to do so if they don't share the burden?
If they don't share the burden.
That we need to draw a line between people and the government. If you let them enjoy visa privilege in Europe and the U.S., how do you expect them to stand up against the regime?
So just a moment ago, Alex, I spoke to one side of the equation, what we're doing to support our Ukrainian partners. There's another side of the equation, and it's what we're doing to hold President Putin and key decision makers in Moscow to account for this brutal, unjustified war against Ukraine. We have enacted the severe consequences that we pledged before February 24th, and we've done so consistently since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine on February 24th. Since that date, we have taken steps to impose visa restrictions on 5,000 individuals in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. We'll continue to identify those who are responsible for Russia's invasion, and we'll promote accountability for their culpability for Moscow's aggression. We are looking at all appropriate tools to hold Moscow to account for this war. At the same time, we want to ensure that we are not closing off potential pathways to those who are themselves fleeing President Putin's repression at home, those who are seeking refuge or safety, the many Russian dissidents, Russian human rights defenders, Russian truth tellers who have stood up to President Putin's war and who may be vulnerable to human rights abuses because merely for exercising what should be their fundamental and universal rights. To your question, we've also been clear that we do have to draw a line between those who are culpable for this aggression, culpable in some ways, and the people of Russia. This is a brutal war that has taken a devastating toll on the people of Ukraine, first and foremost. But the people of Russia have lost thousands upon thousands of their fellow citizens, the financial and economic costs that Russia has suffered because of this, costs that are in some ways passed on to average Russians, those are significant as well. So we want to ensure that we're including, we're continuing to promote accountability, but that we're doing so in a way that is targeted at those who, in the first instance, started this war and who, much more than others, could bring this war to a swift close if they chose.
State Department spokesman Ned Price from today's press briefing. You can see the entire briefing at cspan.org. The United States and South Korea kicked off their largest joint military exercise in 5 years today. The drills are set to run until September 1st and are the biggest between the two countries since 2017. They come as Taiwan's defense ministry said five Chinese aircraft crossed the Taiwan Strait median line on Sunday, and that seven more planes and five Chinese ships were detected operating around the island. Tensions have been high in the region since House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan earlier this month. And Taylor Fravel, who is the director of the Security Studies Power Project at MIT, said the possibility for a U.S.-China confrontation has increased since Speaker Pelosi's visit.
So first, I think this talking point, right, that it's a manufactured crisis and China's overreacting might make the military case more likely if China believes its message is not being heard, right? Or that the stakes are even greater when the U.S. does take some kind of military action, whether it's a straits transit or an exercise near Taiwan, what have you, given the increased, much more frequent presence of PLA forces in these waters. And secondly, I think, as Chris mentioned, right, or the second point I would make here, that so far we have, and I think Christina mentioned, we haven't seen much of a military response. Yeah, there's sort of an announcement that there may be some transits, who knows, but the longer sort of this goes on, I think sort of the greater incentives China might feel to do something in response once it actually happens. And so there's sort of this irony, or there's this tension here between the administration's view that China's overreacting and there is no crisis, that maybe they don't need to do much in response versus, I think, the need to do something in response to the way that the PLA is creating a new normal. So to paraphrase Zhou Enlai and his comments on the French Revolution in reference to the 68 Revolution, not the earlier one, I think it is too soon to tell, and I hope I'm wrong, but I think we are in a period where China has come to the conclusion that the U.S., that it needs to recommunicate its resolve to the U.S. over one China. This has been very clear since Biden's second gaffe last October when Wang Yi began talking about the fake one China policy, which then led to PRC talking points about the hollowing out, et cetera. But I think those do reflect genuine concerns, and China's going to try to find ways of addressing them. And by the way, we're leading into a sort of tense moment in various political calendars in the United States and China, and even to some extent with upcoming local elections in Taiwan, where there may be greater incentives down the road, not too long from now, to sort of show toughness and resolve and to respond to demonstrations of others' toughness and resolve. And so that could take us to a point where we are in a much more conventional kind of IR theory definition of a crisis than maybe where we are on what they say, August 22nd, right? We're in the middle of, I think, something that is changing, and it can be hard to necessarily know where that will lead when you're in the middle of it. But I do, to get actually to your question, I do believe we are in an inflection point, I hope it does not escalate significantly, but I think that the potential has increased, or the probability for it to do so has increased.
That's Taylor Fravel, director of the Security Studies Power Project at MIT, speaking at an event held earlier today at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. You can see the full event at cspan.org. It's also on C-SPAN Now. That's our free video app. According to a new NBC News poll, the enthusiasm gap between Democratic and Republican voters over their party's midterm prospects has tightened up. The poll found that 68% of Republicans expressed a high level of interest in the upcoming election versus 66% for Democrats. The gap was 17 points in March and 8 points in May. And one of the more high-profile races this fall is in Wisconsin, where Republican Senator Ron Johnson is in a tight reelection campaign, and now Senator Johnson is downplaying his involvement in the alternate elector scheme that would have overturned the 2020 presidential election for Donald Trump. The two-term incumbent was asked Friday by journalist Matt Smith from WISN-TV in Milwaukee if he would testify about the fake electors plot before the House January 6th committee.
Is this a referendum on your time in the Senate, this race?
I think it's more of a referendum on Democrat policies and
the Biden administration.
I think so.
There's a lot of issues that could come between now and November outside of your control and the campaign's control. The January 6th committee is scheduling more hearings, likely in September. Have you been asked to testify? Would you testify?
No, I had nothing to do with January 6th.
If they asked you to testify, though, would you?
What would they ask me to testify about?
The Republican electors. And the slate.
Again, another grotesque distortion. I had nothing to do with the alternate slate. I had no idea that anybody was going to ask me to deliver those. My involvement in that attempt to deliver spanned the course of a couple seconds. I fielded three texts and sent two and talked to my chief of staff that somebody wants you to deliver something.
Yeah.
I knew nothing about it. In the end, those electors were not delivered because we found out from vice president's staff they didn't want them delivered. End of story. Again, I know that's been blown out of proportion.
You think so?
The January 6th committee didn't do their due diligence, and they blew this into like some massive conspiracy. Again, I had like virtually no involvement. Literally, my involvement lasted seconds. Okay.
If the vice president's chief of staff wanted to say, don't deliver these, would you have brought that document to the vice president?
In what way could have I? Again, we did our due diligence. So if somebody handed us something, we're supposed to deliver to the vice president. Does he want it? Nope. Okay. End of story. That was it.
Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson speaking to WISN-TV in Milwaukee over the weekend. The latest poll has him trailing Democratic challenger Mandela Barnes 51-44%. Also, in that NBC News poll, voters ranked threats to democracy as a more important issue than cost of living. That's also a change from May, when high prices topped the list of concerns. Of course, gas prices have dropped substantially since then, and the House January 6th committee started holding public hearings. Yesterday, the vice chair of that committee, Republican Liz Cheney, spoke about her loss in the Wyoming primary election last week and the hold she thinks former President Trump has on the party.
What does your defeat say about Trump's hold on the Republican Party?
I think, one, it says that people continue to believe the lie. They continue to believe what he's saying, which is very dangerous. I think it also tells you that large portions of our party, including the leadership of our party, both at a state level in Wyoming, as well as on a national level with the RNC, is very sick. And that, we really have got to decide whether or not we're going to be a party based on substance and policy, or whether we're going to remain, as so many of our party are today, in the grips of a dangerous former president.
In addition to Trump's gloating about your loss, his spokesperson said she may have been fighting for principles, but they are not the principles of the Republican Party. I mean, arguably he's right, isn't he?
Well, doesn't that tell you something? What I'm fighting for is the Constitution. What I'm fighting for is the perpetuation of the Republic. What I'm fighting for is the fact that elections have to matter, and that when the election is over and the courts have ruled and the Electoral College has met, that the President of the United States has to respect the results of the election. And if Donald Trump's spokesman says that those are principles that are inconsistent with Donald Trump's views and inconsistent with the Republican Party's views, I think that ought to give every American pause about who Donald Trump is and about what the Republican Party stands for today.
So this is obviously not the end. This is a new beginning for you. You're starting this political organization. What can you tell us? What are you going to do?
I'm going to be very focused on working to ensure that we do everything we can not to elect election deniers. And I'm going to work against those people. I'm going to work to support their opponents. I think it matters that much.
Will you be getting involved in campaigns against those Republican candidates that are challenging or denying the results of the election?
Yes.
Including your Republican colleagues here in Congress?
Yes.
Is the country better or worse off if Kevin McCarthy is the next Speaker of the House?
Well, my views about Kevin McCarthy are very clear. Mm-hmm. The Speaker of the House is the second in line for the presidency. It requires somebody who understands and recognizes their duty, their oath, their obligation, and he's been completely unfaithful to the Constitution and demonstrated a total lack of understanding of the significance and the importance of the role of Speaker. So I don't believe he should be Speaker of the House. I think that's been very clear.
So it sounds like that's a yes. You think the country would be worse off if he were Speaker of the House?
I don't believe he should be Speaker of the House.
Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney of Wyoming speaking with ABC News' Jonathan Carl. Representative Cheney also told ABC that she expects transcripts, records, and other materials gathered by the January 6th committee over the course of its investigation to be made public. And Senator Patrick Leahy, the Vermont Democrat, is also talking about the January 6th attacks. As Senate President pro tem, he presided over former President Trump's second impeachment trial.
You're elected in 1974, a Watergate baby. Now you're about to leave the Senate after an attack on the U.S. Capitol. What does that say to you?
Part of it says to me, have we learned something? Does anybody read a book on history? January 6th shook me to the core because I thought back to the really wonderful men and women I've served with over all these years in both parties who would not have stood for this.
That's Vermont Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy speaking with CBS News' Robert Costa. Senator Leahy is retiring in January after serving 8 terms. You're listening to Washington Today. Welcome back to Washington Today. Here are some more headlines. The hand recount of Kansas's abortion vote concluded on Sunday with its landslide result reaffirmed. And the Kansas City Star writing, the quote, the recount never had any chance of changing the outcome, but was sought by an election denier and anti-abortion activist advancing baseless allegations of fraud. The recount instead delivered a second victory for opponents of an amendment that would have stripped abortion rights from the state constitution. You can read more at kansascity.com. Pfizer has asked the FDA to authorize its combination COVID-19 vaccine that adds protection against the newest Omicron subvariants. The FDA asked vaccine makers earlier this year to tweak their shots to target the BA4 and BA5 variants that are better at dodging immunity from earlier vaccination or infection. If the FDA approves the vaccine, boosters could be available within weeks. Moderna is expected to file a similar application soon for its vaccine. And as we mentioned, New Yorkers will head to the polls on Tuesday to vote in the state's primary. The state's congressional map was redesigned this year after a long and contentious court battle, and the new map includes a new Manhattan area seat that has turned to incumbents into rivals. Representative Carolyn Maloney, who has represented New York City's Upper East Side for 3 decades, is facing Representative Jerry Nadler, who has represented the Upper West Side for just as long. Each chair powerful House committees, Representative Maloney, the Oversight Committee, and Representative Nadler, the Judiciary Committee. Also running in the same primary is Suraj Patel, a 38-year-old attorney who says it's time for a new generation of leaders. Now, Representative Nadler has been endorsed by the New York Times and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. Here are his latest ad and Representative Maloney's latest ad.
I'm Elizabeth Warren, and I want you to know why I'm supporting Jerry Nadler for Congress. Jerry and I have been in the trenches together for years, taking on bankruptcy laws to protect working families. And Jerry is always leading the big fights, championing women's rights and abortion rights, tackling climate change, passing sweeping gun legislation. New Yorkers are so lucky to have Jerry in Congress, and America can't afford to lose him.
I'm Jerry Nadler, and I approve this message.
1973, Roe versus Wade is decided. From that day forward, Republicans have been desperate to overturn it. I'm Carolyn Maloney, and my story starts in East Harlem.
The English program I was teaching had its funding cut, but I fought until we got it back. Later, I was pregnant and asked my boss about family leave. He said I could just leave. I didn't. On the city council, they said to give up on filing the first marriage equality law in New York. Now it's the law of the land. 1992 Planned Parenthood versus Casey is decided. With the Supreme Court limiting abortion rights, I knew we needed more women in Congress.
And I haven't quit fighting since.
Funding for rape kits.
Federal employee paid leave.
The first female chair.
Today, the Dobbs decision overturned Roe. But being at the forefront of women's rights has taught me we can fight back and win if we just don't quit. I approve this message because it also taught me.
You cannot send a man to do a woman's job.
The latest ad from incumbent House Democrat Carolyn Maloney, and before that, incumbent House Democrat Carolyn Maloney, and before that, incumbent Democratic representative from New York, Jerry Nadler, both running against each other in tomorrow's primary for the nomination in New York's 12th congressional district. Teachers in Ohio's largest school district voted to go on strike over the weekend, 2 days before classes are scheduled to resume. More than 94% of the Columbus Education Association members voted to reject the school board's final offer late Sunday. The Ohio Education Association said the union represents more than 4,000 teachers, librarians, nurses, and other school employees. The OEA said in a statement, quote, "This strike is about our students who deserve a commitment to modern schools with heating and air conditioning, smaller class sizes, and a well-rounded curriculum that includes art, music, and PE." The strike comes as many states face large teacher shortages and shortages of school support staff, one that National Education Association President Becky Pringle has called a, quote, five-alarm fire.
You know, we've been sounding this alarm for almost a decade and a half. And the reason we started talking about it was because we were noticing the decline in the number of students in college who were choosing to go into the profession of teaching. And then we were also seeing so many teachers, especially in that 0 to 5 years of teaching, who were leaving the profession. And disproportionately, our Black and Brown teachers were leaving the profession. So we were becoming a less and less diverse profession. So we started talking about this a decade and a half ago. But as with everything else, the pandemic just worsened it, because the conditions that educators found themselves in, what they were being asked to do at a time of crisis in this country, was just overwhelming. And so we saw so many teachers and our school staff, too, making that choice to not stay in the profession. The NEA did a survey, and we were shocked, honestly, shocked, that 55% of educators said to us that they were planning to leave the profession. And so we are working with them and allies and elected leaders and others to address this reality, not just right now, but this is a chronic problem. And so we have to address it systemically. And that's exactly what we are doing.
Becky, I want to come to you. You know, we've seen some research about the teacher shortage who talks about it being vastly different when it comes to certain states, certain regions. We're talking about, we've heard that the shortage could be different in suburban districts than it is in either rural or urban districts. So can you talk a little bit about the variations with that national teacher shortage and what's driving that?
Tia, that's right. And there's one more thing I would add to the list that you just gave. We also see shortages in certain disciplines. Special education is always at the top of the list for the number of educators that we are short by. Not just that, we're seeing shortages in elementary education, in science and math. So in the disciplines, we're seeing shortages as well. And what I want to be clear about is, you know, this shortage of educators really is about a shortage of resources and funding. It's about a shortage of professional pay. It's about a shortage of time to plan, time to have those one-on-one connections with our students. It really is about a shortage of respect. And that's what we're hearing from educators all over this country. Those shortages do show up in every community, in every state, depending on, honestly, what we've seen it tied to is whether or not that state or that community has invested in their public schools. And in those places where they have not invested in their public schools for decades, we see those shortages even higher. But I want to make clear, you know, I taught middle school science, the Wonder Years, for over 30 years. And this is that time of year where educators are preparing to go back to school. Some have already started, and they are full of excitement and hope. And what they are hoping for is that this country lives up to its promise for our students and that it respects and honors the important work they do.
And you talked about this shortage and its variations. Can you talk a little bit about some of the solutions that the NEA and other organizations have put forward to address these issues?
This is a complex problem, and we know there is not just one answer to it. But we do know this, that when educators talk to me about respect, they mean a couple of things. They, of course, mean with the respect of them as professionals, so giving them professional pay. As we talk with educators all over the country, they know that if they're going to be able to continue to do the jobs they love, they have to be able to take care of their own families without taking two and three and four jobs. And so we have to address that issue, and we have to address it systemically and long term. We also have to address the reality that so many of our students are coming to schools with mental health issues that just got worse during the pandemic. And we don't have the counselors and the nurses, the mental health professionals to address the issues that students are bringing with them. And then we know that our parents need help too, so that they can surround their students with the support they need. And so we are working in collaboration with parents and communities to ensure that we have those resources for our students. Those are the kinds of things that we're focused on. And we know that when we advocate together for those resources for our students, for our schools, for our educators and our families, then we don't see those shortages grow to the really dangerous levels that we are seeing in some communities.
National Education Association President Becky Pringle earlier today on C-SPAN's Washington Journal. You can see the whole segment at cspan.org/Washington Journal. And finally today, as the famous movie line says, in space, no one can hear you scream. But that's unless you're a supermassive black hole. According to the NASA science team that was looking for planets and life beyond the solar system, the idea that there's no sound in space is because most space is a vacuum, which means there's no way for the sound waves to travel. But now the agency has found a galaxy cluster that has so much gas that they've actually picked up sound. And they've amplified and mixed that sound with other data to get the sound of a black hole. Here's what that sounds like. That's the sound from the Perseus Galaxy Cluster. NASA astronomers discovered that pressure waves sent out by the black hole caused ripples in the cluster's hot gas that could be translated into a note that's 57 octaves below middle C. And so they mixed it so that it was audible for human ears. The data comes from NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory, also the Hubble Telescope, and the Atacama Large Millimeter Array in Chile, and maps the wavelengths to a different range of audible tones. It's very, very cool. A reminder that all of our coverage is online anytime at cspan.org. And if you missed any of this program, you can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you'd like more on the stories that are shaping Washington delivered right to your inbox, subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Gary Sterkoff. Thanks a lot for listening today to Washington Today.